like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be here. I would like to discuss the properties of a vacuum of a relativistic field, the simplest case of a relativistic field. And essentially, I will try to summarize all the new results which were obtained during more or less the 10 or 12 years of work on this subject of entanglement in the vacuum. So the outline of the talk. So we do have measurability problems with particles, as we heard. And so instead of particles, let's consider now fields to have something more simple. So it's well known that for fields as well, the measurability problem is not obvious, meaning that not everything that you can measure in non-relativistic theories we can measure in relativistic theories. And the most mentioned issue is that there are observables that if you would be able to measure them instantaneously, they will induce a violation of causality. So just to mention it, just in case, if you have a region of Cauchy surface of T equals zero, and you perform a measurement over here over region A, and you perform another measurement at region B, then even though A and B are causally disconnected, if you still allow to perform another measurement, a third measurement, at the region C, which has A in its causal past and B in its causal future, then if you assume that C is a measurement that you can do instantaneously, then obviously you can use it in order to transform information from A to B. So this is something which is common also to entanglement in ordinary systems like EPR, pairs. You cannot measure instantaneously non-local observables. So this is something that it's obvious that you will see also in field theories. What I would like to mention in the first part of the talk is actually that we have more problems actually concerning measurements. And this will bring us to the issue of how measurements are connected to measurements of entanglement. How can you measure entanglement? The second part of the talk will be actually trying to discuss or explain what is entanglement in the vacuum, and I will use a twofold approach. I will first use the approach in which we implement probes in order to extract entanglement from the vacuum. So this is an indirect approach where you, instead of looking directly at the degrees of freedom of the vacuum, you look at simplified degrees of freedom which interact in the vacuum and finally can be measured. And then there will be the second approach, which is taking the field, discretizing it, sampling it into a lattice, and then on the lattice we can do simpler direct calculations. So these are two complementary approaches that I will compare. And finally, we would like to eventually understand or get a better intuition what is actually the mechanism that gives rise to entanglement in the vacuum. So the main point of those two attempts would be that, in some sense, surprisingly, if you take two regions in the vacuum and you compute its entanglement, it turns out that the entanglement is non-vanishing for arbitrary separation, although you might expect that the entanglement should decay after a finite separation. So what is actually the mechanism that gives rise to entanglement? And each one of these approaches provides another answer, another point of view. The discretized approach provides us some clues concerning the spatial structure of entanglement. And the probe approach gives us some hints about the connection between the Rich-Lieder and the so-called super oscillations. The Rich-Lieder theorem that was already discussed and super oscillations which were actually found in a completely different regime in physics. So let's start by discussing measurements. So suppose I have for simplicity, a one-dimensional field. So it lives on a straight line. There are some degrees of freedom of some phi and its conjugate, which are defined at any point. And obviously, we cannot consider the local degrees of freedom to be a good observables, because if you compute their averages, we get infinities. So somehow we would like to consider averaged observables over the region, some region of some size around some point x naught. So this would be sort of smeared observables like pi, which is smeared with some function around the region x naught, and this it's conjugate pi, which satisfies a commutation relation with each, which can behave like ordinary conjugate variables. But still, we cannot measure something like this because this would amount for instantaneous measurement, which is inconsistent with causality. So what can we do? So let's notice that if we have something, if we consider instead of a spatial average, we consider a temporal average along a world line over a duration t such that the region between minus L and L are in its causal past, then the average over the temporal line is actually proportional by causality, by the fact that this region is actually a Cauchy region which dictates the behavior of the fields in this light cone. Past light cone is actually a sum over the average spatial field and the spatial momentum. So there is a connection actually between measuring spatial temporal averages to measuring a spatial average in space. Now, temporal averages certainly can be measured because we can imagine that we have a certain localized detector which is sitting here with a mass which is with a fictitious mass which is sufficiently large that we can ignore or neglect the effects of smearing that were discussed in the previous talk, or at least we can think about it as a mathematical a construction. And so this might be a way of extracting information on observable at a given time. So this would be nice because ideally we would like to do something, we might want to do something like this. We would split space into segments of size which is becoming smaller and smaller, and we would like to, and we might let compute at each one of those segments the temporal integral. The temporal integral would be equivalent to the spatial integral, the smeared integral over this region, and ideally you would like to swap the averages over the field phi and its conjugate pi into discrete operators, which could be imagined like mechanical oscillators, etc., which might be frozen in time. So if you could do such a swap, then you could ideally consider a set of observables on one side, a set of observables on the other side. The dynamics is frozen. You could measure whatever you want. And of course, there is a time that you have to pay, which is the time of the swap. Can you do such a swap? So something like this would be always consistent with causality, but can you do something like this, actually? So the problem is, of course, that if you do something like this with real observables, then obviously you will emit radiation into the field. And there will be some kind of a back reaction due to the interaction of the measuring device with the field. And the question is, what is the thing going to do to us? So let's consider a toy example, a very simple toy example of something like this. So let us model the field as a simple harmonic oscillator. So the field degree of freedom at a certain segment of the field is modeled by X and P of a single oscillator. And let us model the detector to be by a pair of conjugate variables, capital Q and capital P. And we use the ordinary von Neumann coupling. So this is some coupling which extends over time. This is the G of T is the function which determines how long we couple the two. And now solving the equations of motion or writing the Heisenberg equation of motion, we see immediately that the field actually fills the measuring device as an inhomogeneous source term, which is proportional to the Q. Q is, of course, completely unknown. If you want to have a very high uncertainty in P of the measuring device, then delta Q would be very large. So it will introduce the more accurate the measurement becomes, we want to make it, it will introduce a larger uncertainty into the field. So in such a trivial approach, what will happen is that the measuring device affects the oscillator. It introduces unknown disturbance, and the measured quantity, the measured integral over time is records also this uncertainty, so we essentially failed. So this was known long ago, and actually it goes back to the original study of Bohr and Rosenfeld at the 30s. So of course, in the previous example, we could have done the measurement impulsively, but in fields, we cannot do this because we know that we have all the possible frequencies, unless we, of course, truncate, and then we lose Lorentz invariants. So the idea of Rosenfeld was that indeed there is an uncertain kick into the field, but we can compute the form, mathematically the form of this uncertainty that goes into the field. And the idea was that we can now add something that looks like a spring times Q, the unknown Q of the measuring device, in such a way that the field still feels an uncertain disturbance, but the measuring device reacts back to the value of the field plus something which is proportional to the derivative of this thing over Q times K times Q. So this is something that actually can be, by computing the value of Q, we can make sure that the measuring device actually reacts to the undisturbed value of the field, and we are fine because we are actually measuring the field as if it was not disturbed, although it is in reality being disturbed. So this was the resolution of Wolf-Rosenfeld of this measurement problem, and you can do the same thing for P as well. So we can take this thing back to our example, and we can transform the averages over time and average over P and Q to averages over space, and essentially, as if we succeeded to measure either the spatial, the smeared field of phi or pi, of its kind of conjugate. Does it really work? So can we really do a swap? So we might want to extend something like this and add something that looks like a swap. If we ignore the first term, then the second two terms look like a swap. We actually swap the x of the oscillator to the x of the measuring device, et cetera, for the momentum, and this would be very nice. However, now what happens is that both Q and P, previously Q was a constant of motion, are now not constants of motions, they are functions of the field. So the back reaction into the field is actually now a function of the pointers, which are themselves a function of the field, so there is no way that we can actually compute simply the back reaction on the field and compensate for something like this. So something like this is also happening if you consider, instead of free field theories, nonlinear field theories, where the back reaction is again a function of the field itself. So in general, if in such situation, it turns out, or it seems so at least, that in order to compensate, you will need some extra field plus measuring device terms of compensation, like products of the measuring device times the field. And you can do something like this, for example, perturbatively, if you know that the interaction is small. But such terms will be non-local again. So again, there is no way around this type of non-locality. So the problem of measurability with fields is still, in a sense, open, not only in the sense of inability of measuring everything, but also in the sense of inability of performing, writing down an interaction which respects both causality and give rise to the thing that we want. Nevertheless, we can consider something simpler. We might want to consider entanglement. Entanglement means that we are not really interested in measuring the field observables, but the thing that we want to do is some kind of a method to extract or to swap the entanglement in a region into the entanglement into a set of mechanical degrees of freedom. Say we have an oscillator X1, XP1, which is interacting with region A, another one which is interacting with region B, etc. They are causally disconnected. The interaction with the field is turned off after a finite duration of time. And therefore, we might look now on the degrees of freedom of X of oscillator 1, oscillator 2, and oscillator 3, and ask, well, are they entangled or not? If they are entangled and they were not initially entangled, then we can use something like this as a measure or as a probe of entanglement, which was already in the field degrees of freedom in the regions A, B, and C. So this would be one method to use what we just discussed. However, we should distinguish between two cases. If we want to consider two regions, either the two regions are disjoint, meaning that we ensure that L is larger than twice the time that we open the interaction, which means that the past, the causal past of region of detector one, of trajectory number one, which is the region A, and the causal past of trajectory number two, the region B, are distinct, in which case, if we manage to obtain eventually entanglement, it means that we really can identify the source of the entanglement as sitting in regions A and region B. This is nice. And to a second case where the two regions are actually overlapping. This would be, for example, the case where the two detectors accelerate along a hyperbola, along Rindler trajectories, which describe the two wedges of space-time. So this is something that was often discussed. And in such cases, we have a common source, so we can argue that there is entanglement which was extracted from the vacuum, but we cannot argue that this entanglement originates from two spatially removed regions. So the first approach would be to consider entanglement probes and to exploit the fact that local operations and classical communications, if we have, cannot generate entanglement, extra entanglement. It's already there, so we have two regions, A and B, and we want to ask, are they entangled or not? We insert here local detectors, and we let them interact with the field over a finite duration of time, keeping it to be smaller than L. So the duration of time, the duration of the coupling, actually determines the size of the regions A and B. And if we finally consider the entanglement, which is in the detector's final state, what we get essentially is a lower bound on the amount of entanglement that could have been stored in the field. So this is a way of getting a lower bound into the entanglement of the field between two regions. So what we use here is an idealized pictures of the well-known Unruh and DeWitt or DeWitt detectors. So these are point-like objects. It's an idealization. Which are situated at a given point, so we ignore completely the spread in space, although we can add the spread in space and the smearing in space and convince ourselves that this doesn't change the situation much. And they carry internal degrees of freedom, which are spin degrees of freedom, and we analyze the situation wherein initially the state of the system is the vacuum times the product of the two spins in the ground state. Meaning that initially, we assume that there is no coupling, no entanglement between the two spins and the vacuum. So performing the interaction over a certain time, the aim would be then to compute the reduced density matrix of the two detectors, which for two spins are just a 4×4 matrix. And to examine whether the final state is entangled or not, and of course compute some kind of a measure of negativity. So as I mentioned before, for two hyperbolic accelerated detectors, although it's relatively simple to do such a calculation and you get entanglement, this is not sufficient in order to deduce that there is entanglement between two separate regions in space. It's enough to deduce that you can extract entanglement from the vacuum. So intuitively, you can think about the process that goes on as following. So it turns out that one gets an inequality that needs to be met in order to have the two detectors finally satisfied. This is this inequality over here. And this corresponds to having to the following three diagrams. The term on the right-hand side, which I call the exchange term, corresponds to a event where the two detectors initially are in the ground state, they exchange a virtual photon or phonon and become flip their spin to their excited state up. So this will correspond to an exchange of two of a single quanta. The other two processes are processes wherein each one of those detectors can emit radiation into the field. So these are noise processes. And the condition is that the emission processes are smaller compared to the exchange processes. So the intuition is very simple. If I start with the down state of the spins, then the final state, roughly, is something like the initial state plus a correction that looks like an amplitude where the two spins actually flipped their value to the up state. So something like this by its own is of course an entangled state, but we have noise which corresponds to the processes that the detectors emitted radiation. So this acts to decohere the density. This acts like off diagonal elements in the density matrix which decohere the final state if they are sufficiently large and we destroy the entanglement. So writing this down explicitly, one gets an equation, an inequality, an integral inequality, which contains here the epsilon A and epsilon B, which are actually the form of the window functions, the shape that we decide to open and close the interaction between the localized particle and the field. And the aim is to choose such an epsilon A and epsilon B, here it's the Fourier transform of these objects, in such a way that this inequality is satisfied. So on the left-hand side, we have two a product of two epsilons which correspond to two off-shell processes, two virtual processes where the detectors are in the ground state and they are excited just by the fact that we open and close the interaction. On the right-hand side, we have something that corresponds to a off-shell process where one detector goes to an up state and emits a photon, and the photon is absorbed by the second detector, so it's an on-shell process. So that's good. On the other hand, we have here on the right-hand side a term which oscillates faster and faster as a function of the separation. We can think about it like a window function of the vacuum. And this term actually causes it to be very hard to satisfy such an equation. And for some time, it wasn't clear that something like this can be satisfied for every separation. So it turns out, eventually, and I will come back to it later, that there is a special choice that you can choose for those two window functions in such a way that for arbitrary separation L, much, much larger than T, where T is the size of this region that we are probing in vacuum, this inequality is satisfied, but it's satisfied in such a way that the final amount of entanglement that we extract from the vacuum decays at least as slow as e to the minus L squared divided. So it decays exponentially. So our lower bound is essentially an exponential decay of the entanglement as a function of the separation. So this is the result that we could derive from using detectors, a pair of detectors in the vacuum. We could do something else. We can also ask, can we evaluate a Bell's inequality in the vacuum? So it means that we get very little amount of entanglement, which obviously would not be sufficient to violate Bell inequalities, but we can do something else. We can bring ancillary particles, let them interact with the final state of the two detectors, and then measure the ancillas. This corresponds to filtering the final state of the detectors. And we can filter it in such a way that the entanglement is amplified, is purified, and in these cases, indeed, Bell inequalities can be violated. So for the scalar field, actually, it can be shown that Bell inequalities can be violated for arbitrary separation in space, and related results have been obtained the same year by Werner using algebraic methods. I want to make a few comments before I go to the second approach. The first one is that there were a lot of nice extensions of this attempt. First of all, Massar and Spindal have been able to calculate analytically what happens if you take the detectors to be harmonic oscillators, so these are exact results. There have been other ideas how to do the same thing using a adiabatic method of opening and closing the interaction. If the field is massive, you can do, again, a nice calculation. It was such attempts where have been considered also in curved background, for example, in the case where the universe expands, and these are very nice directions to look at. And we ourselves have been also looking at the case that we have a fermionic field, and the same result have been obtained for fermionic fields. Although, interestingly, there is no, we are unable to prove that that we can violate Bell inequalities, although we can show that we can distill entanglement. And also, we can use a set of N detectors to perform the same idea. So we have N detectors which are interacting with the field, and we ask, what type of entanglement they are carrying? And it turns out that typically they are carrying a W type of state of entanglement and not a GHZ entanglement. Okay, and a final comment here is that this takes us to another direction, which is analog simulations, which are very nice in this context, meaning that here you can really do the exact swap that we mentioned before. So you think about atoms, which play the role of a field, and the motional degrees of freedom is corresponds to the field degree of freedom, and the index I corresponds to the position of the continuous x. So essentially, what you get is something that looks like a discretization of a field theory, and there all those games can be played. So now we go to the second approach, where we actually look directly at the field without ancillary detectors. And it is well known that the field theory can be written down as a lattice, as a discrete lattice, and a one-dimensional scalar Klein-Gordon field theory is essentially just a set of oscillators. I wrote it down here in a very simple form where you just have an interaction between nearest neighbor oscillators with a dimensionless parameter which goes from 0 to 1. It's a function of the spring constant on the masses and the omegas and the frequencies. And when alpha, the coupling, goes to 1, this corresponds to what we are familiar with as the continuum limit of field theory. And the nice thing here is that if we are interested in the vacuum state, which is the case, then the state is just a Gaussian state. The state of the total system is just a Gaussian state. And for Gaussian states, there are well-known methods how to compute entanglement. I will not go into details, but the basic idea is that the full information about the wave function is just captured by the correlation between x's and p's and x's and x's. So we look instead on a 2n by 2n covariance matrix where the entries in this matrix are just correlation between different points of different oscillators. And then there are ways of transforming the question of calculating the entanglement into the problem of diagonalizing this matrix and finding its diagonal form, which contains the so-known the symplectic eigenvalues. And then the well-known entanglement can be entropy can be written down in terms of those discrete set of numbers. So this can be done. This can be done on a computer for a fairly large set of long set of oscillators. And so the previous case was the case of a pure entanglement. So we just considered a bipartite splitting between one set of oscillators to another set of oscillators. And then it's enough to consider just the correlations within the region A. But what we are interested in this case is actually the case where we choose a subset of oscillators in region A and another subset of oscillators in region B. And then it turns out that what you need to do is to construct from the full covariance matrix a smaller covariance matrix, which contains only the correlations between the red group and the green group. And then again, a sufficient condition for entanglement in this case would be to apply the Peres criterion of partial transposition, which here means that the symplectic eigenvalues that you find are smaller than 1/2. So you violate the uncertainty principle, and this corresponds to our violation of the uncertainty principles. And then the quantity that we use is the logarithmic negativity, which is a good measure. And we can go on and ask ourselves how does entanglement behave in a harmonic chain. Okay, so I need to go very fast now. So it turns out that if you look on nearest neighbor oscillators, they are entangled. If you look on next to nearest neighbor oscillators, they are still entangled. But if you go farther away, they are no longer entangled. So entanglement decays for a sufficiently long separation, which is very simple to understand because the correlation decays as a function of the distance, but the decoherence, which is due to the oscillators next to the one that we're interested in, is constant. So eventually the entanglement decays to zero. How is it consistent with the results from the probe? So it's obvious that what we need to do is to take larger and larger groups of oscillators. And if you take larger groups, it turns out that the distances that you can take them farther apart become larger as a function of the number very quickly. So it means that if we go to the limit of having infinite number of oscillators or sufficiently large number of oscillators in each group, and similarly for the separation, we eventually get a numerical result for the behavior of the logarithmic negativity which shows that essentially entanglement decays exponentially like L divided by by the size of each of those groups. So this is a better, slower decay of entanglement as a function of the separation, but it's still exponential. Recently, some of those results have been computed analytically. So now we go to the last part, and here I want to ask how is it that entanglement persists for arbitrary separation? What is the mechanism which governs it? And let's look first on the lattice perspective of the problem. So from the lattice perspective of the problem, it's important, it would be useful to notice actually a Gaussian entanglement that we have here has another property, which is that if you apply a unitary transformation, you can transform a set of entangled oscillators to pairs of oscillators which are entangled. So entanglement is essentially a mode by mode. It's mode-wise entanglement, and there is no entanglement which is more complicated than an EPR type of entanglement. So we can analyze the entanglement properties in terms of a single EPR pairs. And the question here is, where are those EPR pairs located in space? And to answer this, we actually ask, what is the connection between the local oscillators to the global oscillators, the global oscillator degrees of freedom, which are obtained by transforming the local Qs to some global Qs? There is some function which we call participation function, which is quantified by the by U and V, which describe how local quantities connect to the collective quantities. And here I want to show you how it looks like in the case of a two-dimensional lattice, where we choose a region and we ask how do those modes of the look like in this region. So if we are all familiar with the area law, the area law will arise from entanglement which sits on the boundary of this region. The claim would be that the long distance entanglement should be actually related to internal modes that we are going to see, which actually sit here in the center of this region, and they are in a sense isolated from the environment. So this is, I want to show you a little movie of a set of 15 times 15 oscillator block as a function of the mode number with ordered with decreasing entanglement as a function as the picture goes on. So this is the first mode, it's the area mode, and here are the other modes. So as a function of the number, we see that the first modes are actually very close to the boundary. But as we go farther and farther to modes which carry less entanglement, and the entanglement here decays exponentially as a function of the number, the modes become more concentrated in the center. Eventually, what we're going to see is that the most internal modes are such that they don't have support outside this region, meaning that they are less and less susceptible to the effects of decoherence of the modes of the oscillators outside this region. So the conjecture here is that when you're looking at those two regions which still carry entanglement, there are some modes which are sitting there, which are isolated from the effect of the environment, however, they pay the penalty of carrying very little amount of entanglement. If you could talk with these kinds of modes, you will get pure entanglement between those two regions. So this is the first attempt to understand entanglement. Now let's go to the second point of view of the probes. And here the claim is that the effect of probing entanglement is somehow connects between the Risch-Lieder theorem, which was already mentioned, and super oscillations. Risch-Lieder theorem, very shortly, means that this is a sort of a state preparation in a more general form. We can do here a local action, prepare whatever we like very far away, but in the vacuum it has a more powerful form, because you can interact or state prepare remotely along very different regions in the vacuum. So how does it work in this case? So let's recall that actually we had to satisfy this type of inequality, and there was a problem. The problem was that here we have a function which oscillates very quickly as a function of omega. And the problem is that the window function that we use are such that they are limited in time. So they are open only between 0 to t, which means that the window function epsilon epsilon actually oscillates like 1 over t rather than l, which is much, much larger than l, or the period of oscillation of the window function is much, much slower than the one which corresponds to the vacuum window function. So they don't resonate. So essentially, the right-hand side actually decays to exponentially to zero very fast for a normal window function. What we did to resolve this problem is we picked a very special window function. This window function was essentially a super oscillatory window function. So epsilon of A, epsilon of the detector, which acted off resonance to emit a photon, had the form that in frequency space, had the form that as for omega plus a capital omega larger than zero, which is the region where we want to resonate with the vacuum window function, it oscillates much faster than the normal frequency of oscillation, which is of order t rather of order l. L is much larger than t. So it has the shape of which looks like something which is very large at the region which is a non-physical region which is omega smaller than zero, and something which oscillates very fast for the region which is omega larger than zero. So as a consequence, what happened is that the two functions actually oscillate, if we pick it correctly, oscillate with the same frequency. And this is the way actually that we managed to satisfy the inequality, but with the price that the amplitude here is exponentially small. And this is the result, this is the reason for the bound, the exponential bound for the entanglement that we obtained. How does it connect to the Rich-Leader idea? So let's consider the case that at t equals zero, we start with a vacuum state and we apply this very unique window function on the to the field, meaning that we let the detector interact with this very special window function with the field. So after a finite duration of time, the action on the field would be the integral over the t, integral over decay. This window function times e to the I omega kt times the creation operator. Do the integration over time. Integrating over time takes the window function to the form, the Fourier transform of this of the original window function, which we just claimed that has a super oscillatory form structuring this in this regime, meaning that it has it behaves essentially like in this regime as sine kl. It oscillates very quickly in this regime. Add this together to the exponential contribution, and immediately we see that what this does essentially is that it shifts the particle that we have just created to a distance of size L. So essentially what we have here is an experiment, a Gedanken experiment, where you can, in a sense, illustrate the Rich-Leader theorem in a restricted case where you let a detector interact over a finite duration of time, pick a certain very rare final state of the detector, and if you manage to pick this final state, you see that very far away, there is exactly the right fluctuation in the field which was already there, which describes effectively a particle which was moving faster than light into the other region B. And this is, in a sense, the essence of the Rich-Leader theorem. So let me end here, and I'm sorry if I kept going. Thank you.